Jim and John.
Quality.
That's right. It's quality over quantity this morning. We have a number of bills. We have legislators moving in and out of committees. So there will be some order to this. But in general, in almost every case here, we're just going to take testimony this morning. And in almost all cases, we're going to lay bills over for consideration for our omnibus. This might be the one exception to that. Yep. Senator Bonoff's legislation needs to go to taxes.
Right.
So, Senator Bonoff, we're going to honor your punctuality.
Thank you.
And welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm here today with a bill for the Minnesota Science and Technology Authority. The plan for this bill is the result of a study and development by the Advisory Commission that was comprised of nearly 20 of the state's leaders from the industry, the investment community, and higher ed. The ability to generate new technologies and quickly take them to market is a competitive advantage for building strong economies and one of the fastest ways to recover from job losses of recent years. Minnesota, unfortunately, is one of the few states without a comprehensive strategy to create the science and technology jobs of the future. The Minnesota Science and Technology Authority's strategic plan meets this need. In short, the statewide plan has three key objectives that have both intermediate and long-term impacts on our economy. This plan will accelerate our ability to turn ideas into commercial products and services. It will foster the startup and success of new high-growth companies and enhance the ability for our existing industries to remain competitive and be leaders in their market. It is imperative that this Minnesota legislature establish and fund an aggressive science and technology economic development initiative starting in 2011. Companies from the state's heritage industries of forestry, mining, and agriculture, as well as recent industries such as biotech and renewable energy, depend on innovations in science and technology to sustain their growth. We face a crisis of competitiveness not only in the U.S., but around the world, as we know. The way that we plan to pay for the fund that will serve many functions, and I'll let Betsy talk about how that fund will function, is to create a very innovative approach that we won't take the time in this committee to understand. It will go to taxes to understand. But what you should know is that we look at the industry as a whole, this sector, and we say, figure out how much revenue they are bringing to the general fund today. Using that as the base, we take their growth and say, okay, this growth is just coming from this sector. We're going to take 85% of that growth and put it into a special fund, which will then go towards creating new and exciting companies for Minnesota. So with that, I will allow the experts to speak exactly about what this fund will do, and I'm proud to be joined by Betsy Luffs, who is the Executive Director of the Minnesota Science and Technology Fund.
Ms. Luffs, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee, for hearing our bill today. I realize it's a jam-packed day, so I will keep it short and sweet. We have the report that we put together, the strategic plan, shows that we have a gap in services and a gap in investment in funding high-tech job growth. Minnesota has fallen to a ranking of 42nd out of 50 in how we grow entrepreneurial companies here in the state. We have so many resources between the academia and large industry, and how do we help grow the small industry? Because we know that's where the 85% of the job growth comes from. So when we take the fact that we're sixth in science and scientists and engineers, and we're 42nd in job growth, we have a big gap to fill. So the creation of the Science and Technology Authority will serve that on that continuum of job growth. It will serve in the pre-seed venue. So based on different programs I will describe, we will help invest in companies that the funds will be leveraged, and then we can help grow jobs for the state of Minnesota. So one of the funds is the Technology Commercialization Fund, which would be matched. It would require a match. There would be a payback that required of this, and this will help grow jobs, and Robert will talk some about that. We would establish a business acceleration program. So you have scientists and engineers, and they need help in the business side, so it would be a hand-holding program that would help them get to the point where they're prepared to present to angels and investment and venture capital if they need to do that. We would establish a federal liaison program. There's a lot of funds available through federal grants for research and development and commercialization, yet you all know the federal government is a big entity. So how do we help steer these companies through that system? We would provide additional funds for small business technology transfer, small business innovation research recipients, because once they get the funding, they need additional funds to move forward so they can commercialize their product, which in the end grows jobs. And what is the end result we all want? But we would like export, you know, someday to have export part of that too. How do we help the young people stay here? We would create an internship program that would be matched by industry, and this would be replicable in every county of the state. So getting these interns into a job and getting them to stay in the field that they choose then would help, and every state has this challenge. I'm from Ohio. We had it as well. How do you get the young people to stay here? So this is a job creation tool using science and technology as the base. And I'm going to cut it short right now because you have a packet in front of you that I gave my copy to. It looks like this. We've got a lot of information in here. We have a cheat sheet. We have an article that was written by Margaret Anderson Kelleher that I just got this morning, which was fabulous. But I would like to say a little bit about Robert. Robert's going to tell you he's a rocket scientist, and it's true. And I'm going to give you – he's never said this in testimony, so I'm going to say this briefly. When you work with the Department of Defense, you have levels of achievement that you have to reach. Normal companies with two and a half years of funding maybe get to maybe a level four, which is a bread box. 2.5 years of funding with about $1.5 million, correct? Robert's team got to a 7, which is demonstration, in a semester. So that is when I say he's a rocket scientist, I wanted that to be in testimony when he tells you his story, so you can hear how we've helped him move forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lawson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Also, I just wanted you to know that we created this in legislation last year, this particular entity, and so I think we should all be proud of the work they've done so quickly, and I've actually had members of my community call on me and share the work of the commission. I think that they have created the seeds of something that is pretty powerful going forward. So, Robert.
Welcome to the committee. If you could just give your full name for the record, Mr. Rocket Scientist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Robert Malachy.
Thank you, Mr. Malachy. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm aware that you have the packet in front of you with the presentation, and I'm not going to read to the presentation. I'm sure you all can follow the presentation. It basically states facts, and you can read at your own leisure. I am the CEO of a small company started here in Minnesota in 2008. The name of the company is Soli, so it's not Zoli. It's Soli. It's the Hmong word for lightning. So let me tell you a little story about Soli. It was started in 2008 by four engineers. And we were tasked to invent something that was basically a problem for Lockheed Martin, which was to land their small UAVs. And a UAV is an unmanned drone. And when I say small, we're talking about something that can be hand-thrown. What we didn't know at the time is this is a problem that is costing taxpayers hundreds of millions of dollars a year. These small aircraft cannot carry the precision landing systems that can land these aircraft safely. They are basically crashed, and these are not cheap aircraft. So we were tasked to solve this problem, and it was deemed not just difficult at the time, but impossible by all the experts in the field. We spoke with the experts at many of the top institutions, Georgia Tech, University of Minnesota, several others, including across overseas. So, to land an aircraft optically, there's one glaring problem, one huge hurdle, and that is to be able to determine the absolute three-dimensional orientation of that object using just a camera. So, this has been a problem that has plagued robotic vision since its inception. Vision is an extremely complex problem. Some would say that it's impossible to defy the laws of physics. Well, being the you know, diligent and upstanding engineers that we were, we decided not to try to tempt that path, but decided to, I'd say, cheat the laws of physics. So we've created a technology that propelled robotic vision 10 years into the future. We can do three-dimensional orientation of an object using two-dimensional imagery in one pass on a processor that you can all carry in your cell phone. Now, I know I'm sure you guys can't quite fathom exactly what that means, but it allows for a robot to navigate an environment intelligently. It allows it to know what it's seeing, system identification. These are all things that everyone's been trying to do, but the technology is just not there yet. So we patented the technology, we created a company, and we demonstrated the world's first optical-based landing system for a small aircraft ever. We add only about 2 ounces of weight to the aircraft. 2 ounces. And we can precision land any aircraft. And it's scalable up to a jumbo jet. Now, we didn't really understand the implications of the technology, but it's implementable across any field of robotic vision. We can apply it to automotive. We are now the featured technology for one of the prime contractors at the upcoming world's largest unmanned vehicle convention as a partner with one of the prime contractors. And we are now working with the Department of Transportation to develop smart cameras for traffic. So the implications of the technology are very broad. We haven't had the ability to go into all the areas that I can go into because we just haven't had the bandwidth, the funding. It is very difficult for a small technology company to raise money. The first dollar is the hardest. I can't express to you how important the grants that we received from the Department of Economic Development have helped us. They provided the initial money that allowed us to continue operations. I mean, I've been told many times by small business starters that the secret to being successful is staying open one more day. And basically, we received $80,000 in state grants, which doesn't sound like a lot, but we invented this technology to TRL 7 level, as Betsy explained, with $2,000. With $80,000, we were able to stay open, continue our development, and develop our basic business prowess so that we could actually market the technology. When you come out of college, you have this kind of altruistic idea that if you invent something that everybody needs, everyone will come to you. And that's not exactly the case. We need this technology. Minnesota needs this technology. And with the state grants, we were able to take the technology to a level that it was recognized by all the major players. The military is now interested. We have 2 prime contractors now working with us. We've already secured over $500,000 in contract in 2010 alone. But what the grant money does is several things. It provided the first level of vetting. When you have a technology directorate funded by the state as your... Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry for taking up all your time, Mr. Jack.
Mr. Malachy, this might be the most interesting testimony that we get today. But we do have to get some others, too. So
I apologize.
I appreciate how you're wrapping it up, and I'll give you a few more seconds.
Okay. Well, to make things short, we went from 2008 with 4 founders in my living room to 13 employees, high-paying engineering jobs in 2.5 years with an $80,000 investment by the state. We have many contracts going on, and it's allowed us to get the investment we've needed. And it just wouldn't have been possible without this. The guidance, not only the guidance, the money, the guidance, and the help. And I really hope that you guys can understand just how critical this is. Thank you for your time. I apologize for going over.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Malachy. Again, that was very interesting. Members, for the record, we do have a quorum. This bill has another stop, and maybe, Mr. Malachy, you'll be given another chance to testify even further. I'm sorry we don't have more time with you today, but we will move you along. So, members, Senator Metzen moves that Senate File 300 be recommended to pass and refer to the Tax Committee.
Tax Committee, yep.
All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Bill is approved.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Next up, we will take Senator Dames and his legislation, Senate File 437. Senator Lilly, if you could take the mic.
Morning, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Welcome, Mr. Dames, Senator Dames. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. I'm here today to introduce Senate File number 437. Senate File 437 is a bill for an act relating to economic development, appropriating money to the Minnesota Inventors Congress. We're requesting $50,000 in fiscal year 2012 and $50,000 in fiscal year 2013. The mission statement of the Minnesota Inventors Congress is a nonprofit organization dedicated to serving inventors through the encouragement of innovation and invention and the provision of information, assistance, and support of all phases of the innovative process. With me today, I have Deb Hess. Deb is the Executive Director of the Minnesota Inventors Congress, and Deb will give us some information. Also in your packets, Mr. Chair and members, you should have a copy of this handout. And at this point, I'll turn it over to Deb.
Good morning.
Good morning, Ms. Hess.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for this time. As Gary said, my name is Deb Hess. Sorry, Senator Dames. Gary. Oh, we go back many years.
Yes, we do.
From Redwood Falls, Minnesota, and I do have the honor of serving as the Executive Director of the Minnesota Inventors Congress. I do want to thank all of you for your support that you provided inventors and our organization over the past 26 years. Because of that commitment of helping inventors create jobs, we have actually over 2,000 contacts with inventors throughout the year. Our Inventors Resource Center, our target audience is the aspiring inventors. It isn't the engineers like the gentleman that you just saw. It's the people who have an idea and honestly don't know where to go next. And we are unique in this country. There is no other organization in the United States that provides year-round access to knowledgeable staff to guide them through the process. A little background on the MIC itself. We have three major programs, and we began in 1958 when a group of farmers and businessmen decided that they wanted to keep the young kids in the community, and they knew that new ideas and new products created new markets, and new markets create jobs. So they hosted the event, and this year we're hosting our annual event. It's our 54th, where inventors test market their products, and anyone can attend any of our 18 Inventing Success workshops. Someone that has an idea and is new to the world of inventing actually doesn't even know what they don't know. By connecting with fellow inventors and experts, they begin to understand the process of developing a marketable product. We have 15 people who travel in from across the country, which actually equates to about $10,000 of out-of-pocket costs because these are donated in-kind contributions to our organization, and that doesn't include their speaking fees. And these people are there to network and connect with the inventors and help them develop their ideas. That's just one of the pieces that happens. So from one of our inventors, he said, displaying my invention at the Inventors Congress gave me an affordable way to present my invention to the public for the first time. In doing so, I gained the confidence and knowledge to pursue manufacturing options and to begin developing a marketing strategy. The seminars provided by the MIC helped guide me through what I perceived as shark-invested waters as I sought to capitalize on my invention. Little Bug Stoves are manufactured in Stacy, Bemidji, and Roseau, Minnesota. The stainless steel blanks are cut in Stacy, and then they are formed, packaged, and shipped from Bemidji. Pouches for the stoves are manufactured in Roseau and help to provide economic opportunity for persons with disabilities. The success of Little Bug Enterprises supports other businesses besides manufacturing. I use the services of graphic designers, printers, web developers, accountants, law firms, and shippers, all of whom support the Minnesota economy. From not knowing a thing about invention or starting a business, I am now the CEO of an S Corp. And this is in large part thanks to the Minnesota Inventors Congress. And that's from Kent Herrig from Bemidji, Minnesota. And I can share many more stories like that, but it would be, you know, the similar type of information. In the handout that you have is information about the expo, the dates and everything, so I won't go into any of those pieces. You have that for, you know, time to read when you have a few minutes to spare in your day. But back in 1985, when the legislature provided us with an appropriation, we opened the Inventors Resource Center. Since then, that appropriation has been used to help connect inventors with reliable resources. With one full-time and one part-time staff, we work all year to teach inventors how to develop a product. It is truly networking in action. One example is a phone call I received last week from an economic development advisor from the Boise Fort Tribe. He had an inventor in his office, and this gentleman had an idea, and he honestly didn't know where to go next. And so we talked about all of the different stages that you go through. And he was about ready to sign a contract with an invention development firm who was promising him amazing outcomes if they would just pay him a small fee for his signing of a contract. And what we talked about is the fact that this company was just fined $10 million for misleading inventors. And Davison & Associates is one of those companies that in their contract they're required by federal law, and it states that the total number of consumers who submitted new product ideas to Davison during the past 5 years is 589,418. What it goes on to say in that contract is that the total number of consumers in the last 5 years who made more money in royalties than they paid in total under any and all agreements with Davison is 14. So the percentage of income that Davison receives from the royalties paid is 0.001%. People don't know about these invention promotion companies. You see their commercials on television, newspaper, radio. And what we do is help them understand that those companies do nothing to teach you how to make good business decisions. And so I consult with inventors literally on a daily basis and help them understand the process. It hasn't changed from the very beginning. You can have a great idea, but if you don't have good management, it is almost impossible to take it through. So, again, you know, repeating myself, that we just help educate them about the importance of connecting with people who do understand that you have to be a part of the industry your invention is a part of. So, to wrap up real quickly here, because I know that your day is very full, the third leg of our program is the Minnesota Student Inventors Congress, and about 10% of the appropriation is typically set aside for the student program. And since 1988, student inventors from across the state have access to inventing curriculum, and many earn the opportunity to exhibit at our expo. This also adds to the ability to network with other entities. We have a youth science retreat in Willmar on April 9th. If you're familiar with the Midwest Technology Campus, we're working with some of the scientists and engineers from the 19 different companies there that are going to have a free event for 6th through 12th graders. And we'll be having hands-on demonstrations and exhibits. So it's a free event, so put down April 9th on your calendar to recommend any families to come for a great day. In a nutshell, we provide year-round staff, which connects inventors to the information and experts they need to get their products into the marketplace. As one of our board members stated, we are the eHarmony.com for inventors. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Hess. Senator Deems, anything further?
Just that we would appreciate the support on the bill.
All right, very good. Without objection, the chair lays over Senate File 437 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you very much for your testimony today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We appreciate the opportunity.
All right, next we're moving on to the biobusiness appropriation. Senator Nelson. Senator Nelson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm pleased to bring before you my motion to lay Senate File 501 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. I'd like to thank Chair Michelle for sponsoring this bill with me, as well as Senator Metzen. Also, Senators Rosen and Senator Sparks are co-authors. Because I'm a former teacher, I just want to make sure y'all have the right stuff from your packet. There's lots in your packet today, but this is what you're looking at. PowerPoint and a lot of fantastic letters of support that I hope you'll take a moment to read. This bill provides funding for the Biobusiness Alliance of Minnesota. It's known as BBAM. And we're asking to continue funding at the current level of $1.75 million for the biennium. I'll be making an oral amendment to that regard. Might I do so at this time, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Nelson.
Okay, I would move that we insert the number 1.75 on line 1.5.
Carlin, could you please repeat the amendment to that bill? just one sec. Senator Nelson, could you please repeat what you were saying?
Yes. I would like to offer an author's amendment. Please insert the number 1.75 million on line 1.5.
Okay, Madam Chair and members. The amendment is on line 1.5 in the blank, insert $1.5 million.
$1.75 million.
$1.75 million.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Nelson.
Do we need to adopt the amendment?
Yes. All right. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? So moved. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. Founded in 2005, BBAM grew out of Governor Pawlenty's Bioscience Council. BBAM is a private-public partnership with a board of seasoned leaders representing the private sector, academia, and government. At the time of the founding of the alliance, you might remember this, critics in our state were saying things like, oh, it's too late. This train has left the station in regards to biobusiness. Fortunately, BBAM has been able to show that the critics were wrong. The Biobusiness Alliance first measured and reported our progress in the private biosciences marketplace, both for employment and the economy. Second, the Biobusiness Alliance has created a statewide business plan called Destination 2025. I'm sure you're familiar with that. That is to show where our bioscience resources are strongest and where we are weak, and then how to improve. Finally, most importantly, the Biobusiness Alliance has been working with groups like the University Mayo Clinic Genomics Partnership to help commercialize and take our research into job creation, and with individual companies to help connect them with the resources to grow their jobs in Minnesota. With me today, members, is Dale Wahlstrom, no stranger to this committee, the president and CEO of the Biobusiness Alliance of Minnesota. Mr. Wahlstrom spent 25 years at Medtronic. He led the company's largest division. He chaired the governor's Bioscience Council and then took an early retirement to lead the Biobusiness Alliance. Mr. Wahlstrom is a native Minnesotan who shares my belief that the creation of a strong bioscience creator of our economy is essential to providing our grandchildren with the foundation we need for the future security of our state. The backbone of that foundation are innovative startup companies. After all, some of the state's largest companies started as small, high-risk ventures. Medtronic, for example, started in Earl Bakken's garage. In addition to Mr. Wahlstrom, we have Dennis McFadden, CFO of Ativa Medical, one of the 200 companies that the Biobusiness Alliance has assisted. And with that, members, I'll turn it over to Mr. Wahlstrom.
Mr. Wahlstrom, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, thank you very much for the introduction. I'll make my comments short because I'd like to make sure that we have time to listen to Dennis McFadden. I would like to make a couple of introductory comments, however. Like I shared with the House last week, the worst part of my job is coming here every 2 years and asking for money. We wish we didn't have to do that. Unfortunately, there is a need to fund what we do. For every dollar that we bring in, however, from the state, we more than match that money from other sources. Part of the reason that we're here, though, continuing to ask, is that whenever we do go out to companies, foundations, individuals looking for investment, their standard response is, love what you're doing. Is the state it's providing its share of support to you? And there's a general belief that if we don't have some level of state involvement, that they won't participate either. So we're back here again asking you for money to keep this operation going for the next 2 years. In your handout, there are there's a whole packet of measurements. I'm not going to go through those. We would like to just summarize a little bit, however, though, that over the course of since 2008, since we started tracking the progress of our efforts, we have been going back every year and talking to the companies that we worked with. Since 2008, we were able to account for 2,700 jobs plus being created with the 193 companies that we had worked with over from 2008 to the end of 2010. Those same companies are predicting to create an additional 2,186 jobs over the next 3 years. Those same companies have brought in about $133 million worth of investment into the state, of which the vast majority of that is from outside of the state. Our cost per job created so far is around $4,000, and with a cost to the state of around $2,000 or less. A rough estimate on employee taxes paid in 2010 was around $9 million. And if the companies do what they say they're going to do, predict they're going to do, that number will be somewhere around $18 million by the year 2013. So we're really proud of what we've done up to this point. I'd love to tell you that I'm the sole reason for that. I can assure you that I'm not even close. It's the very large number of volunteers, very seasoned CEOs, business people, academics, government people who are serving on our board, mentoring CEOs who are first-time CEOs, providing day-to-day support and feedback to companies that are trying to get off the ground. And in line with that, I'd actually like to point out that I think there was handed out recently, or today, an article which was just published in the Wall Street Journal last week, which we're quite proud of, which points to it's this document, which on the back side it talks about the Angel Tax Credit that you helped to pass last year and the formation of what we call the Minnesota Angel Network, which is a network to support that Angel Tax Credit to allow for the mentoring and systematic growth of companies to the point where they are fundable. And we were recognized in the Wall Street Journal. And I might add, the Minnesota Angel Network is one of our projects. In fact, Todd Leonard sitting in the audience is the person that's come on board as seasoned entrepreneur to help put that online. So we're proud of that. But it's just one example. But for now, I'm going to quit. And I'm going to turn this over to Dennis McFadden, CFO of Ativa Medical, that is one of the 193 companies that we worked with over the last 3 years. So, Dennis?
Thank you. Thank you, Dale. My name is Dennis McFadden. I'm the CFO and VP of Corporate Development for Ativa Medical Corporation. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. We are here to speak on behalf, of the BioBusiness Alliance of Minnesota. It is a subject that is near and dear to our heart and also to all of those companies that they support in the state of Minnesota. Ativa Medical, a little background. We're based in St. Paul. We are at the UEL facility. We are developing the world's first micro lab that can perform more than 25 routine blood tests at the point of patient care with a single drop of blood. Our toaster-sized instrument at about $10,000 in price, it has the equivalent functionality of machines that in total cost about $400,000. Ideally suited for emergency departments, physicians' offices, and clinics, our products will be marketed around the world beginning next year in 2012. Our objective is really to improve patient care by reducing cost, improving availability of diagnostics for the 50% of the population in the world that today has no access to blood testing. We are building our company with strong partnerships, including 3M in St. Paul, Honeywell in Golden Valley, Lasix Industries in White Bear Lake, and Benchmark Industries and the Mayo Clinic based in Rochester. And I think we all know where Mayo Clinic is. To perform a test, and this is in fact the mock-up of the system, one would simply, like a glucose test, get one drop of blood onto a cartridge, slide it into the system, and within 3 minutes, you would have the results of a blood test. This is absolutely critical in remote clinics and particularly in remote locations like in China that do not have access to this kind of testing.
Mr. McFadden, we'd appreciate it if you would check Tomasoni's blood today.
He doesn't have a heart.
We can work on that later.
We have had an investor come to our facility, and we tested his very blood. It's an unusual request, but we can accommodate. But we do have an X-Acto knife in the house. Let me tell you a little more. In 2005, David Dietz, our founder, he had intended to start this company in San Diego. Through the efforts of BBAM, and I have to say that BBAM was very persistent and persuasive, he opted to start in Minnesota instead. We operated from a garage overlooking Bald Eagle Lake for a period of time, and then in 2008, we moved to the current facility. We acquired this technology from Honeywell, and they had spent 10 years to develop it. We are bringing it to the finish line. We currently have a team of 25 highly skilled, highly educated individuals. They are educated at the University of Minnesota, at St. Cloud State, and my alma mater, St. Thomas. Our partners, which we've mentioned earlier, they have an equal number of people, so we effectively double our workforce through our partnerships. And we have been funded primarily by Minnesota investors, angel investors that have put in about $5 million into our company. While California and Massachusetts dominate the diagnostics industry, Minnesota is absolutely ideal for this opportunity. And this, frankly, could give rise to a brand new medical device sector, not unlike Medtronic and others. We have aspirations. Our core technology and development partners are here. There's a ready availability of the talent and all core competencies that we require to bring this product to market. There is a savvy angel investment community. And finally, there is BBAM. Without the folks at BBAM, the collaboration which allows companies like ours to thrive and grow, it simply would not exist. As I mentioned, we have 25 employees. The current payroll is about $2.1 million annually. We anticipate over the next 5 years that will grow to approximately 120 employees and approximately $11 million a year payroll. Our strategy is to leverage partnerships across the state, and we expect that our workforce is effectively doubled by our partnerships, both in terms of today as well as our future growth. In addition, we will spend over the next few years several $1 million in capital equipment, predominantly from Minnesota-based companies. Let me close by saying that BBAM has convinced us to stay in Minnesota. They've given us access to prominent leaders and capabilities around the world, which we otherwise would not have had access to. Without BBAM, we would not be in Minnesota. We would not be rapidly growing jobs in Minnesota. We would not be building the foundation for what could be a new medical device sector. We believe BBAM is an unsung treasure in Minnesota. I strongly encourage your continued support of BBAM by providing full funding over the next biennium. It is a relatively small investment with significant rewards and dividends for companies such as ours and, frankly, for the state of Minnesota. And with that, I thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. McFadden. Senator Nelson, anything more for the committee at this point?
This is what our committee is all about, jobs, getting them here, keeping them here, growing them here.
Mr. Wallstrom.
Mr. Chair, with your permission, I'd like to try to excuse me, I'm losing my voice today. I'd like to try to draw a correlation between what we do in the Science and Technology Commission, which you heard, your authority, which you heard about a couple of speakers ago. When Ms. Luff made her testimony, and she mentioned the fact that there were four different components to that bill. In fact, we represent one of those components in one industry. We are the life science industry, which is a really large aspect of our state. However, I say this to you because we are a strong advocate for S&T, and we recognize that S&T, the authority as defined, is a really important aspect that had we had the kinds of programs that are involved in that bill, that instead of having created 2,707 jobs, we'd probably be in the area of 5,000 to 7,000, because a good portion of the issues that we deal with are around our financial in nature. When we bring jobs forward, when we bring companies forward, when we support them, like S&T Authority is intending to help take across more industries, we have the way we approach it is to go find money in other places like from Saudi Arabia to down the street, and everywhere in between is where we've gone, and that's where the $133 million so far has come from. Had we had local capability to incent and local capability to support, the rate of improvement would be dramatically better. At the same time, money alone without trained, experienced, seasoned people to provide support to those investments will have minimal impact as well. So if you take an organization like BBAM and an initiative like the S&T Authority and you put them together, you create a very powerful mechanism for job creation within the state across all industry segments. So with that, I just wanted to throw that nickel out there, even though it wasn't part of our testimony, because what we're all trying to do is create an ecosystem that is sustainable for growing our economy and our job proliferation engine here in the state. So thank you, Mr. Chair, committee.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would just urge the committee, as we consider this for inclusion in the omnibus bill, I would really strongly advocate for the full funding. As you can see, it's a very modest investment with great results, doing exactly what we've talked about here, creating jobs here, growing jobs here, keeping jobs here. And I know we get lots of information at these great hearings, so I'll just capsulize just a couple statistics that you'll find on the handout. And you notice that the jobs cost, which is something I always figure out when we look at appropriations, how many jobs were created and what was the cost per job. And you'll see it's $4,000 per job, and the average wage is over $62,000, $9 million paid a year in taxes. And you've heard the job numbers. So I just thank you for the hearing and the opportunity to bring this before you for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a couple of questions. Senator Nelson, in your bill, I think we just did an amendment for $1.4 million for appropriation, correct?
Mr. Chair, you're 1.75.
Thank you. Sorry, I didn't have the exact number.
Senator Torres-Ray.
1.75. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in the chart for appropriation, we have 960. And I was wondering what is the reason for the change in the 850, I guess it is now. It's almost double. The request is almost double.
We're going to look to Mr. Wallstrom for that.
Well, I don't, Mr. Chair, we just don't have that chart in front of us, so I'm not exactly sure what you're referring to, but I'll defer to Mr. Wallstrom.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, this is our budget chart, so this is the appropriation that we have appropriated for this organization in the past. It was at the level of 960, and the request is for almost double that. So I was wondering what is the reasoning of that large increase.
I'll ask Mr. Wallstrom, and then I'm guessing Mr. Jensen might have an answer for us as well. But Mr. Wallstrom first.
Okay, Mr. Chair. Senator, the appropriation 2 years ago was $1.75 million, of which $1 million was base, and then $750,000 was a one-time allocation. It came out of the Commerce Department. So I believe that the target you're looking at is probably the $1 million minus the unallocation that took place last year by Governor Plenty's action. So I think that's probably what you're looking at. But the initial allocation 2 years ago was 1.75.
Mr. Jensen, do you want to give a little either confirmation of that or a little more history on the numbers for this particular program?
Mr. Chairman, members, those are the correct numbers, and that's what has happened this biennium. So they did have 1.75, and then through the unallotment process, it's down to $960,000 for the biennium. And the governor's recommending another 25% reduction. His number is down to $712,000 for the biennium.
Thank you. So this number of the 960 is after the unallotment?
Mr. Chairman, yes. And the governor is recommending a 25% reduction from that number.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I have another question.
Sure.
And thank you for that clarification. I'm quite this is a new committee for me, but as I hear the presentation of the Minnesota Science Technology Authority and read a little bit about the Minnesota High Tech Association and look into the BIOS Business Alliance of Minnesota, Mr. Chairman, it occurs to me that I would like to have a review of how the state of Minnesota actually supports these ideas and collaborates. And I think we have two of the organizations here. And I would like to know more about how you collaborate and how, you know, I understand that your work is very much in the bioscience and these kind of businesses. But as I think about, you know, how all of your efforts kind of move in the same direction, it seems to me that I don't know if there is a way to collaborate and if you are doing similar work, your missions are separate, similar. Did you get together to talk about how you conduct your business?
Mr. Wallstrom.
Okay. There is a tremendous amount of collaboration that takes place. If you take like Minnesota High Tech Association, Life Science Alley, Defense Alliance, those types of organizations are membership organizations. They have membership that drives them. So whoever their members are, who they support. In the case of Science and Technology and the BioBusiness Alliance, they're different in that it's as is the partnership with the university and Mayo. So if you take BBAM as an example, we are that organization is a 501c3 nonprofit charitable purpose organization intended to be focused on job creation within the state. So what we do is we work with all the organizations, including S&T. In fact, the first public advocation for the S&T authority came from the BioBusiness Alliance. When we published Destination 2025, our number one recommendation on all six of the industries that we support, and we created a strategic plan for it, which is one correction I'd like to make in a positive way to Senator Bonhoeff's testimony when she made a comment that there is no strategic plan. We do have one, which is Destination 2025 for the state of Minnesota in the area of life sciences. So what we're trying to do now, and I am a member of the S&T Authority, so we've been working with Betsy and her team all along, and what we're trying to do is to take the applications orientation of a BBAM-type operation and begin to look at how do you expand that type of support out across all industries, and in addition, how do you then add the kinds of state programs that are helpful in catalyzing job creation locally? Because without a complete package that involves the responsibility of the public sector, the academic sector, and the private sector, you don't get a completely functioning, call it an ecosystem, whatever you want to call it. You need all of them functioning together. So we, although in these environments, it's very difficult when you're testifying in a situation like this to create a complete story that makes sense for all of you. But behind the scene, there's a tremendous amount of dialogue taking place to make sure that the work is synergized amongst those groups as much as possible. And I can tell you that today, in 2011, that amount of collaboration and synergy is several orders of magnitude greater than it was in 2004 when I first got exposed to it while I was still at Medtronic, but began volunteering to do the Bio-Business Alliance approach. And I'm going to add one thing to that. The reason I volunteered is I'm a native Minnesotan. I happen to love this state. I've lived in 9 other states and 2 other countries, and I always come home. This is a very special place. Unfortunately, what was really troubling to me is that for the last 10 years that I was in making, and I was vice president and general manager of one of the business units, and I was making hundreds of million dollars worth of investment, less and less and less of it was being done here because of the lack of the knowledge community that we were after and that we needed to be able to expand our business and grow what I was responsible for. I didn't like that. Nobody likes it. So that's why so many of us are now volunteering to try to help turn this around and are trying to collaborate across all of those various groups that you referenced. But it is, it's big. It's complicated. So I can understand very well how someone who gets pieces here and there has a difficult time putting it all together. But I know I speak for Betsy. I know I speak for Margaret Anderson Kilahar, that if there's an interest in a part of the Senate or the House or both to sit down and look at this from a total systems point of view, we would all drop whatever we're doing to be there to kind of lay it out and say this is how it all works together.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Nelson and Mr. Wallstrom. Mr. McFadden, are you Senator? Excuse me, Senator Cohen.
No, I thought you were calling to see if they had anything else. Or?
I've called about 3 times to see if they have anything else, and it's continued. So I think Senator Nelson's doing pretty well. I don't think she needs anything else. Senator Cohen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, let me make my position clear. I think the Bio-Business Alliance is one of the real success stories, and Senator Torres Ray, relative to your question, difficult times, we won't have the ability to do it, but I wish we could appropriate more money because I think this is I've been a co-author of this request in the past, and this is one of the real success stories. But, Mr. Chairman, I'm compelled to say, relative to this request and the other requests, that my fear is that, Mr. Chairman, I address this to you not just simply as chair of this committee, but also as one of the Senate leaders, that the governor has some significant disappointment with the direction of the session. And he's made it clear that if we continue on the same path, and obviously, Mr. Chairman, you well know that between today and May 23rd, whatever the date is, there's just leagues ahead of us. We'll have just all sorts of stuff packed in. So I realize today is not May 23rd. But he does feel if we're going on the same path, his intent is, and he's made it clear, is to line item veto any of these requests. He's fearful that Deed, which he had been the commissioner of with Governor Perpich, and which he recognizes as the centerpiece for job creation in this state relative to state government, that he's fearful he's going to have to do things like eliminate the trade office, which was of great pride to Governor Plenty, line item veto a lot of these requests. And I do feel compelled to suggest, as I have before, and this is coming more directly from the governor, as he's indicated, a real disappointment that in this budget process that there has not been the opportunity for his commissioners and his budget to be presented, not as a budget that ought to be adopted by the Senate, but to have the give and take, as every other governor has had, going through the detail of the budget pages to understand the integration of his budget with what's happened in the past, what this governor would like to do. And given our timetable, I mean, with Deed, you'd normally have hearings for a week with the Deed budget. Obviously, there's not the time to do that. And he's fearful that with kind of the two ships passing in the night, that a lot of this stuff is not going to last. Now, I say that in the hopes that that will not be the case come May 23rd or whatever the date is, because, again, I'll repeat that there's a lot of time between now and then. It might be 2 months, but it'll be like an eternity, as we well know. But I hope that if we don't have much success over this next week before the budgets are out, that there'll be some serious work with the administration to understand what the governor is presenting. But he did publicly, I think, yesterday indicate, and Mr. Chairman, you probably saw this, that he did indicate that his intent would be that he'd be forced to just go through DEED, as well as the other agencies, but given the importance of DEED, to go through the DEED agency and the pass-through grants with clearly a hatchet of some sort, or axe, or whatever the metaphor is.
Senator Cohn, I don't know where to start on that. Are you suggesting that the governor would want a line item veto, for example, the project that's before us that it's in his budget? It's in his budget, as I understand, that it's been presented mm-hmm. a month ago. We still are waiting for the actual governor's budget bill. So if you have that, let me know. But I've never heard such strong language from the governor or his administration or someone on your side of the aisle suggesting that the governor is getting ready to line item veto things. Am I just hearing you wrong?
To some extent, you are. Mr. Chairman, I said there's a lot to happen between now and May 23rd, so he's not line item vetoing anything. But he put out, I believe, yesterday some thought of what he'd have to do if we continue on this present trend, and he feels that he'd be left with no choice. I will respond, however, to the question about the budget. I got the budget in front of me. The budget book has his budget in it. You don't need a bill. You got the budget right here in the detail with line items. I can see kind of line items. The budget pages keep on getting smaller and smaller over the years. There's less detail than there was in past years, and that's an ongoing complaint with every administration. But you've got the budget in front of you. At least we all have the budget in front of us. So we don't need a bill. We got the budget. But I think the governor is very concerned. I mean, you saw the letter he sent to Senator Koch yesterday, I'm sure. And he's very concerned as to how this process is working.
So Senator Cohn, that letter did not use the word line item veto at all.
Oh, okay, that's fair. It did not. Absolutely did not. But I think he's indicated that he would have great difficulty in being able to approve a lot of these appropriations. One, with the way the Senate budget's going, I think he's made that clear. And he offered a number of examples, not relative to some of this, but he offered a number of examples in the letter to Senator Polk, I believe. And second, he's very concerned that there's not the opportunity to have a fuller exposition of his budget. I mean, we've got the budget right in front of us. And I can tell you in past years, Senator Tomasoni can tell you this, you know, and you know, Sarah Michelle, from your work here, Mr. Chairman, that you would spend several days normally with the DEED budget. That's what we did with previous governors. And unless we're going to do nothing else between now and next week, obviously we're not going to have several days to spend on the budget, this particular agency budget.
I'm tempted to continue this conversation with Senator Cohn, but I want to honor the at least two other bills that we have in front of us. Let me just probe one more point, Senator Cohn. So when you chaired the Senate Finance Committee, was a budget book enough for you, or did you want to actually see and pass legislation out of the Senate Finance Committee? Because we do have a budget book, but we don't have a governor's budget in the form of legislation.
Mr. Chairman, historically the budget books have been enough. So we've never worked off of...
You would pass a budget book, Senator Cohn?
No, we'd pass a budget bill promulgated through the work we did.
We have no such bill, Senator Cohn. We have no such bill. It's been a month.
Chairman, you're going to create a committee bill. We know what the process is like in that regard.
Well, we will, but we don't have a governor's bill, is my point.
Mr. Chairman, during the years I've done this, we have worked from the budget books as presented by the governor. Not a budget bill, but the budget books. We have the budget books in front of us. I'm looking at it right now. That's what we would work from, and you know that perfectly well from the years you've been here.
Well, and so we've had, for instance, on DEED, we've had Commissioner Phillips in twice, and I have no doubt we'll have him in again, and that'll be important.
But Mr. Chairman, if you allow me, I don't want to get into a lengthy discussion. I just want to make the comment.
Well, I think Senator Cohn, so you finish.
Yeah, those were the overview hearings. Those weren't the budget hearings.
Well, Senator Cohn, you might have been absent, but we had a very specific hearing with Commissioner Phillips where he went through what they called the change items, which some of us would call
cuts, and that's fine, but we allowed the commissioner, in his discretion, to get as specific as he wanted to and to present them in his way, and I think that is that's absolutely what the committee process is for. If you feel like you haven't gotten enough from Commissioner Phillips, you should bring him in. You should call him. I guarantee he'll be here again next week.
Well, and hopefully we'll have a chance to get a fuller exposition. But Mr. Chairman, the comment is, and I just want to, you know, the governor's letter sent to the majority leader yesterday was I think, relatively pointed. And I think he's just concerned. I want to express that concern as a member of this committee. And do so to yourself, again, obviously, as the person who's chairing the committee, doing a good job of it, but also somebody who's one of the leaders in the Senate.
Thank you, Senator Cohen. Thank you, Senator Nelson. Mr. Wallstrom, without objection,
Mr. Chair,
on this bill?
Yeah, just a quick question.
Okay, Senator Kielash.
We're including these bills as
a question
possible.
For Senator Nelson?
Actually,
or?
It's for you, sir.
Okay.
It has to do with the procedure. We're including these in the omnibus bills without voting on them. I just thought.
No, we're laying them over for consideration.
Is that what you're. Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry.
So without objection, Senator Nelson's Senate File 501 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. Next, we have Senator Peterson with Senate File 708. Mr. Peterson, if you could, Senator Peterson, if you can come and I've got at least two or three testifiers, so if you could have them join us as well.
Good morning, members. And,
good morning, Senator Peterson. Why don't you introduce the Senate bill in any way you wish, and then your testifiers. And I'd ask you guys to keep an eye on the time. You know, roughly 10 minutes. And I don't know if we'll have stick to 10 minutes, Senator Peterson.
Chairman, I'll make my introduction short. This is Senate File 708. Twin City Rise needs no introduction for this committee. Not really. I know many of you have talked to them the last several weeks in regard to this project. I simply want to thank the other authors, Senator Metzen and Senator Tomasoni, yourself, Chair Michelle, and Senator DeCrafe. The thing that I was most excited about this appropriations bill is that it's a pay-for-performance model. And in the sake of time, we'll just move directly into the testimony that folks have for us here today.
A brief introduction. Senator Michelle, Ms. Chairman, members of the committee, Henry Van Dellen on behalf of Twin Cities Rise.
Mr. Van Dellen, welcome to the committee. Nice to see you
thank
again.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thanks to all of you for the hard work you're doing on behalf of the state in this difficult budget year. Some of you know that I was a House member back in the 1990s, and at that time I was known as somewhat of a fiscal hawk. But for several years since then, I have come back to the Capitol to support this program because I think it is uniquely accountable to the taxpayers. The program takes all the risk of delivering graduates from generational poverty to living wage jobs that affect not just their life but their children and their broader community. And the unique pay-for-performance model, I think, needs to be held up as symbolic of what is right about what the government does on behalf of the taxpayers in a private-public partnership with this nonprofit organization. With me today is Shelley Jacobson, the Chief Operating Officer, who will spend a couple minutes talking about the program and its successes, and then a couple of graduates, Tony Blakely and Quentin Osgood, will also tell you their stories.
Great. So, Ms. Jacobson, you're up first. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. We really appreciate your time today. I think it's really important for you to hear about the outcomes that we have at Twin Cities Rise. As you know, we're an anti-poverty program that provides intensive work skills training for chronically unemployed adults, culminating in a full-time living wage with benefits. Here we have key outcomes for 2010. Nearly 800 were served. We have a success rate of 66%. The average change in annual income was 246, 6%, 246% annual change in income. Think about that for someone living in poverty. Job retention, after 1 year, 82% of our graduates were still on the job, and after 2 years, 71% were still on the job. The return on investment for the state of Minnesota, $7.24 for every dollar that was invested by the state. And we have a 70% improvement on recidivism. So all of those outcomes together really create a unique pay-for-performance model that we have with the state of Minnesota. And there are many, many other statistics and information that I could give you about the program, but I think it's more important to hear from people who have actually been involved in the program. And we have two of my personal role models and heroes with me, with us today. They are both graduates of Twin Cities Rise. And what's unique about both of them is that they are both employees of Twin Cities Rise. Now, normally we would try to come to you with individuals who are not necessarily working for the organization. But fortunately for us, this is a daytime hearing, and our graduates are working and unable to get away. So we have brought with us Quentin Osgood and Tony Blakey, and I'm going to turn it over to Quentin to share his journey with you.
Mr. Osgood, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, I'll just give you a quick testimony, make it real short and brief. I was told that I would never be dung in my life. At the age of 14 in the system, at the age of 20, moved to Selby in Victoria, where they spent thousands of dollars to shut it down, got caught up in that drug war, became addicted to drugs, ended up being in the system over 26 years, 11 felonies. 98 was the last time I was incarcerated, Ramsey County Correctional Facility. Ended up looking for a change, found Twin Cities Rise. Heard that they were giving people jobs. Give me my job. Well, it's not like that. So we learned a few things and stuck with Twin Cities Rise and ended up getting off of paper 3 years early, honorable discharge, Judge Marinin. Ended up working for, I've been working for Twin Cities Rise now 6 years, paid $43,000 worth of child support back, own a home, a car, voting. They helped me turn my life around. I'm not perfect, but I believe that through Twin Cities Rise, through the empowerment, because we help individuals to believe in themselves and learn who they truly are, through the empowerment I've learned that even though I may make mistakes, I've learned that I have the ability and the power to continuously, confidently correct my mistakes and make myself a better man. And I owe that to Twin Cities Rise. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Osgood. Mr. Blakey, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I do appreciate being able to spend a few moments with you this morning. Again, my name is Tony Blakey, and I am a graduate and employee of Twin Cities Rise. Just a little bit about myself. I'm originally from St. Paul, Minnesota. I was actually adopted. Let me move back just a little bit. I was adopted and moved to St. Paul as an infant. So growing up, I had quite a bit of an identity crisis. Wasn't quite sure who I was. Also dealt quite a bit with rejection. Reason being is that there was the situation of being adopted, and then also the situation of having a father who moved directly across the street from my mother and my sister with his new family. And I had a stepsister who was a year older than I was, and a stepbrother who was the same age as my younger sister. Going up through high school, fighting to find out who I was a very tough ordeal for me. And then graduating high school and having to deal with the reality of the real world and not knowing what direction I was going to go in caused me to find myself being homeless at some point in time as an adult. I spent time eating out of trash cans, eating off the streets, and actually sleeping in a park across the street from my father's home. I often found myself also in a recreation park looking at a mural of young kids playing football, which reminded me of when I was a kid, because I was actually told when that mural was being painted that I was one of those children. So it brought back to me what happened to that little kid, where did his life go, and how did I end up where I am, homeless and broken as a man. Well, I'd found myself to the point of almost wanting to give up, throwing the towel. Now, not saying that I was to a point of wanting to take my life, but I thank God for Twin Cities Rise, because Twin Cities Rise helped me to find my life. Twin Cities Rise is an opportunity for all individuals to regain dignity, self-respect, and confidence in themselves, to become productive taxpaying members of society, and have a strong foundation not only to stand on, but to build on. Long gone should be the days of benevolent oppression, where individuals are given assistance with no real opportunity for growth and self-sufficiency. Twin Cities Rise provides this for people who are struggling not only to get ahead or support their families, but to effect true and positive change in their lives and make a difference in the lives of others. I am a walking testimony to the transformation that takes place in individuals who attend Twin Cities Rise. And so I say with a sincere heart, please support the efforts of Twin Cities Rise as a program. As a program, it is outcomes driven. It also helps individuals recognize their core values, which is the sense of self that tells each and every one of us that we are important, valuable, and lovable human beings. It also helps individuals to identify and overcome their core hurts. Our core hurts are those things that are false judgments about the value of who we are, about the value of self. Twin Cities Rise, in the past 2 years for me, has moved me from a position of being weak and unsure to starting out as an administrative assistant, to becoming a work skills coach and empowerment facilitator, to being accepted and participating in the Shannon Institute Leadership Program, to also being accepted and participating in the Promised Neighborhood High School Age Committee. I have accomplished more in the past 2 years and have found myself over the past 2 years solely due to the encouragement that Twin Cities Rise has installed in me. I didn't have much family or people to support me, but I found a new family. And the people that are not only sitting here with me today, but in the people that I deal with on a daily basis. Twin Cities Rise not only helps you to become self-sufficient and do for yourself, but it also helps you to give back to the community and affect change and hope into the lives of other individuals who were in the same exact situation. So I want to thank you for your time this morning and truly hope that you lend your support to the efforts of Twin Cities Rise, because it truly is a gem of a program. And when people are skilled and trained, they are ready for work. And that is the purpose for Twin Cities Rise. Once again, I thank you all for your time this morning.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Blakey. Senator Peterson, any concluding remarks? Mr. Van Dellen or Ms. Jacobson, anything else you want to add to the record? I have Senator Tomasoni with a question or comment.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, since I'm one of the co-authors, and I noticed that the mission statement says it pays a living wage of at least $20,000 annually plus benefits, I'm just wondering if you're all okay with the deletion of health care benefits in the bill.
Ms. Jacobson.
The reality is that we would love to continue having with health benefits in the bill. However, it's becoming increasingly hard in this economy to find positions for our participants that include health care benefits as well. And so we want to make sure that we're able to continue to have participants go through our program, get livable wages, whether or not there is health benefits.
So
Senator Tomasoni,
are you going to remove plus benefits on your mission statement then?
Thank you, Senator Peterson, and thank you, Twin Cities Rise, for what you do. That was nice to give you a few minutes at the microphone there. Without objection, members, to be laid over for consideration for omnibus bill. I have Senator Tomasoni, then, with Senate File 486. Is that a signal for a handout,
yes.
Senator Price? Dad, I'm going to have to take this one. So, Senator Tomassoni, it looks like you're going to have a little help. I would ask if there's anyone else that wants to talk about this bill, if they come to the table with you. And Senator Tomassoni, Senate Bill 486.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Mr. Chairman, just thinking about the time that we have left here, but I'll very quickly describe the bill and then turn it over to Mr. Price to describe the program and the jobs that are being created by the program. This bill is basically appropriating $500,000 each year for the next 2 years to the Conservation Corps to create jobs and to teach the youth of our community skills and develop the training and assistance they need to restore and maintain our natural resources, and in the same time not only do that but develop these young people into productive citizens of society and actually give a return back to our state as a result of what they do. And it seems to me that this is another type of program that we have in this committee that does exactly what this committee says it does, and that's create jobs and put people back to work. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll turn this over to Mr. Price, and he can give you a little bit more explanation of what the Conservation Corps does.
Thank you, Senator Tomassoni. Senator Price, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Len Price. I'm the Executive Director of Conservation Corps Minnesota. It's good to see some familiar faces and some new faces here. It's really also great to follow the previous testimony because it's so compelling, and it is another feature of what nonprofits are able to do in our communities across the state of Minnesota to try to help young people in all different stages of their life cope with their difficulties. And this proposal that you have before you would help the Conservation Corps of Minnesota achieve some of the training goals that it has. Conservation Corps of Minnesota has been around as a nonprofit 501c3 since 2003. I asked the page to distribute an annual report for 2009. Our new one is at the printer, so this is the best we can do today. And also a chart that shows the kind of trainings that we do. We have programs for high school age youngsters, and we have programs for 18 to 25 year old individuals across the state of Minnesota. We are associated with AmeriCorps. That gives us some distinct advantages for what the benefits are for the people who are enrollees or Corps members, as we call them in our program. I don't know how much time we have here, so I'd just like to hit a couple highlights to talk about the job part of this program. These young people are exposed to a crew-based model in their everyday work. The crews could be as low as four or five young adults working out of any number of places in the state of Minnesota doing hands-on natural resource work. We do work on public lands or on private lands if they're part of a program that's publicly funded. Our young people, high school age youngsters, are in crews of typically six people with two adult crew leaders, and they too are doing hands-on work. They are typically working in state parks or on other facilities that are federal facilities. The crew model is very good because they learn a lot of job skills. They learn team involvement. We have a high number of ethnic and racial minorities in our crews. We recruit heavily from across the state. A typical crew that would really be good for our young people that are high school age would be two youngsters from outstate Minnesota, two metro inner city youngsters, and two suburban youngsters, and then possibly a deaf or hard of hearing individual in that crew, because we have made a point of trying to keep about 20% of our slots in our summer youth program, an 8-week residential program, for deaf and hard of hearing youngsters. So there's this interface between the hearing community and the deaf community. Many of our young adult Corps members are college graduates. They hope to continue a career in some kind of natural resource management. Many of them, because we're associated with the AmeriCorps program, are eligible for what's called an AmeriCorps Education Award, which currently is equal to a Pell Grant, which I think is around $5,200 or $5,300. So if this young person serves for a year in our program, at the end of their service, they get a voucher. They can take that voucher to any college, university, or their person that they borrowed the money from to go to school already, and they can pay off their past debt or they can go back to school. And if you look at the bottom of the chart that I provided for you, you'll notice that about, and we've only been operating since 2003, so that's not a real long history, but you'll notice that about 39% of the individuals in our program go back to school to get further training. And so by virtue of us being here operating, this opportunity is available to our young people. A lot of those folks we know have gotten jobs with federal, state, county agencies. I know for sure that this number is pretty solid. At least 150 people at Minnesota Department of Natural Resources were engaged in either the old Minnesota Conservation Corps or the Youth Conservation Corps of the 70s and 80s. Cortland Nelson, who's the Commissioner of Parks and Trails, told me just recently that he was a YCC-er. That's good testimony that this kind of a program embellishes that interest in that arena and career field. Depending on where you're stationed in the state and the particular program you're in, you could receive any number of types of specific trainings. All of our young adult corps members are certified to be wildfire fighters, and we have an arrangement with the Department of Natural Resources to respond to wildfires, and we do that on a regular basis. We're also trained in wilderness first aid and GPS, so we are involved in emergency response. I can tell you several anecdotes about where we've been. There isn't probably a lot of time for that. They're all certified in chainsaw skills. And that comes in handy for lots of reasons. We do a lot of natural resource trail work, tree pruning, and the like. They get a lot of job orientation, resume writing, letters, et cetera, that are good for them when they leave. They're ready to exit the program so that they're ready to either move on to go to school or look for gainful employment. You can see them in the middle chart on the handout that I gave you. And then there's just regular job skills that they receive. So why in the world are we coming here for the first time ever to try to secure some of this funding? Because we think we've reached a point at 400 individuals per year where we really need some help to sustain this training. We currently receive a small general fund appropriation, $455,000 a year. We've had that appropriation at a higher level when we left DNR back in 2003, but we've grown. When I became executive director in 2005, we probably had about 160 total people in the program. Today, we're over 400. And so we are really stressed in terms of the ability to continue this level of great opportunity and training for these young people. So we really appreciate your support. I've sat on every side of this table in my professional life, and I know the stresses that you are faced with. I know the difficulty of establishing priorities and taxing your value system to say, you know, there's this request, and how are we going to address them all? I'm going to rely upon your good judgment to see if you can help us sustain a very successful program, a very transparent program. We're required to file a report every year with the committees that we get the money, the general fund money through. We've done that. You can reference library this report. You can see what our track record is. You can look at our annual report and see the success stories. I could entertain you for a day with anecdotes about the good things that happened to people.
Don't do that.
I won't. Okay. And so with that, I would like to thank you for this opportunity and entertain any questions.
Senator Tomasoni, do you have any concluding remarks? Senator Price, nice to see you again.
Thank you.
Thanks for your continued service. Senator Tomasoni?
Only that, Mr. Chairman, that once again, this is about jobs, and that's what we're all about. And this is from the Workforce Development Fund, I should point out also. So is this to be laid over for possible consideration, Mr. Chairman? I have no further comments other than I would like to see us entertain the possibility of funding this because it's about getting people to the next step, and they've been very successful at it.
Mr. Keeley?
Yeah, just to back up with Mr. Price was saying, this is a great program for the DNR. They have a workforce that's been trained and ready to go in and work in remote areas, and they've done a lot of great work in that, and I think it's really helpful to have this organization doing this for the DNR in many cases, and other private firms as well to take care of our resources in this state. So I think this is a very valuable program in a variety of ways, not just the jobs, but also for the kind of work that they can do for the state that we would have to somehow find other resources to pay for it.
All right, members, so without objection, we'll lay over Senate File 486 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Members, just a couple of housekeeping notes. Senator Sieben, whose bill 428 was first on our list, she did ask us to pull it from today's agenda, and that she'd be working, checking in back with us and staff as to when that bill is ready. So that's why you didn't see Senator Sieben. Also, most importantly, it's Senator Daley's birthday. Senator Daley. Oh. You didn't think you'd get it.
I thought you were going to keep under the radar.
So Senator Daley is buying lunch today, which will be
fabulous. Fabulous.
And members, we have just two more notes from me. Just remind you that tomorrow's committee, the Wednesday committee, will be starting at 10:15. Same room, but 10:15 tomorrow instead of 10:30. We've got a number of bills to get through. Senator Tomasoni, we have another one of yours, the OIC bill. Senator Torres-Ray, we have one of your pieces of legislation, Senate File 761, the Neighborhood Development Center bill. We have a bill from Senator Howe. We have a Lilly. We have a Metzen. Make fun of Metzen. And a couple other members who are not on the committee. So we'll have another full day tomorrow, members. Committee's adjourned.
Arla, what did you think?
No.